crouching. She gave a little feint, but the soldier simply stood his ground. A second soldier ran up to stand beside him. The third soldier was behind her. He also stepped out onto the dome. She moved to her right, but the two men came directly toward her. The third was closing in behind. The two men were just a few yards away from her when she heard a loud crack like a gunshot, and she looked down to see a jagged line open in the plaster between them. The soldiers scrambled backward, but the crack was already widening, sending branches out like a tree. The cracks went between their legs. They stared down in horror. Then the plaster fell away, and they dropped from view, screaming in terror. Meanwhile, she glanced back at the third man, who was sprinting for the walkway when he tripped and fell flat. He landed with a crack, and Kate saw his frightened face as he lay there, feeling the plaster beneath his body slowly give way. And then he fell with a long cry of fear. And suddenly, she was alone. She was standing on the ceiling, with the birds shrieking around her. Too frightened to move, she just stood there, trying to slow her breathing. But she was okay. She was okay. Everything was okay. She heard a single crack. Then nothing. She waited. Another crack. And this one she felt directly beneath her feet. Looking down, she saw the plaster cracking in several directions, streaking away from her. She quickly stepped to her left, moving for the safety of the rib line, but it was too late. Her foot crashed through. She fell to the level of her waist before she could throw her body flat, fling her hands wide, spreading the weight. She lay there for several seconds, gasping. She thought, "I told him it was bad construction." She waited, trying to figure out how to get out of this hole. She tried to wriggle her body. Crack! Directly in front of her, the plaster opened in a jagged line, and a huge chunk broke loose. And then she felt the roof give way beneath her. She knew in a moment of horrible certainty that she, too, was going to fall through. In the plush red room in the tower, Chris was not sure what he had heard through his earpiece. It sounded like Kate had said, "They're coming to kill you." And then something else, which he didn't catch, before the static became constant. Merrick had opened the wooden chest near the little altar, and he rummaged through it hurriedly. "Come on, help."
"What?" Chris said.
"Oliver keeps his mistress in this room," Merrick said. "I'll bet he keeps a weapon here, too." Chris went to a second chest at the foot of the bed and threw it open. This chest seemed to be filled with linens, dresses, silk garments. He flung them in the air as he searched. They fluttered to the floor around him. He found no weapon. Nothing. He looked at Merrick. He was standing amid a pile of dresses, shaking his head. No weapon. In the hallway outside, Chris heard running soldiers coming toward them. And through the door, he heard the metallic zing as they drew their swords from their scabbards. 29 hours, 10 minutes, 24 seconds. "I can offer you Coke, Diet Coke, Fanta, or Sprite," Gordon said. They were standing by a dispensing machine in the hallway of the ITC labs.
"I'll take a Coke," Stern said.
The can clunked to the bottom of the machine. Stern took it, pulled the tab. Gordon got a Sprite.
"It's important to stay hydrated in the desert," he said. "We have humidifiers in the building, but they don't work well enough."
They continued on down the corridor to the next doorway.
"I thought you might want to see this," Gordon said, taking Stern into another lab. "If only as a matter of historical interest. This was the lab where we first demonstrated the technology."
He flicked on the lights. The lab was a large and untidy room. The floor was covered with gray anti-static tiles. The ceiling above was open, showing shielded lights and metal trays holding thick cables that ran down like umbilicus lines to computers on tables. On one table, there were two tiny cage-like devices, each about a foot high. They were about 4 feet apart on the table and connected by a cable.
"This is Alice," Gordon said proudly, pointing to the first cage. "And this is Bob."
Stern knew that by long-standing convention, quantum transmission devices were labeled Alice and Bob, or A and B. He looked at the little cages. One held a child's plastic doll, a girl in a pioneer-style gingham dress.
"The very first transmission occurred here," Gordon said. We successfully moved that doll between the cages. That was 4 years ago.
Stern picked up the doll. It was just a cheap figurine. He saw plastic seams running down the side of the face and body. The eyes closed and opened as he tipped it in his hand.
You see, Gordon said, our original intention was to perfect three-dimensional object transmission, three-dimensional faxing. You may know there has been a lot of interest in that.
Stern nodded. He'd heard about research work.
Stanford had the earliest project, Gordon said, and there was a lot of work in Silicon Valley. The idea was that in the last 20 years, all document transmission has become electronic, either fax or email. You don't need to send paper physically anymore. You just send electronic signals. Many people felt that sooner or later all objects would be sent the same way. You wouldn't have to ship furniture, for example. You could just transmit it between stations, that kind of thing.
If you could do it, Stern said.
Yes. And so long as we were working with simple objects, we could. We were encouraged. But of course, it isn't sufficient to transmit between two stations connected by cables. We needed to transmit at a distance, over airwaves, so to speak. So we tried that. Here.
He crossed the room and came to two more cages, somewhat larger and more elaborate. They were beginning to resemble the cages Stern had seen in the cave. These cages had no connecting cables between them.
Alice and Bob, Part 2, Gordon said. Or, as we call them, Allie and Bobby. This was our test bed for remote transmission.
And?
Didn't work, Gordon said. We transmitted from Allie, but never got to Bob. Ever.
Stern nodded slowly. Because the object from Allie went to another universe.
Yes, of course, we didn't know that right away, Gordon said. I mean, that was the theoretical explanation. But who would suspect it was actually happening? It took us a hell of a long time to work it out. Finally, we built a homing machine, one that would go out and back automatically. The team called it Alley-Alley Income Free. It's over here.
Another cage, still larger, perhaps 3 feet high, and recognizably like the cages that were now used. The same three bars, the same laser arrangement. And? Stern said.
We verified that the object went out and back, Gordon said. So we sent more elaborate objects. Pretty soon we succeeded in sending a camera and got back a picture.
Yes?
It was a picture of the desert. Actually, this exact site, but before any buildings were here.
Stern nodded. And you could date it?
Not immediately, Gordon said. We kept sending the camera back again and again, but all we got was the desert. Sometimes in rain, sometimes in snow, but always desert. Clearly, we were going back to different times, but what times? Dating the image was quite tricky. I mean, how would you use a camera to date an image of a landscape like that?
Stern frowned. He saw the problem. Most old photographs were dated from the human artifacts in the image, a building or a car or clothing or ruins. But an uninhabited desert in New Mexico would hardly change appearance over thousands, even hundreds of thousands of years. Gordon smiled.
We turned the camera vertically, used a fisheye lens, and shot the sky at night.
Ah!
Of course, it doesn't always work. It has to be night, and the sky has to be clear of clouds. But if you have enough planets in your image, you can identify the sky quite exactly. To the year, the day, and the hour. And that's how we began to develop our navigation technology.
So the whole project changed?
Yes. We knew what we had, of course. We weren't doing object transmission anymore. There wasn't any point in trying. We were doing transportation between universes.
And when did you start to send people?
Not for some time.
Gordon led him around a wall of electronic equipment into another part of the lab. And there, Stern saw huge, hanging plastic sheets filled with water, like waterbeds turned on end. And in the center, a full-size machine cage, not as refined as the ones he had seen in the transit room, but clearly the same technology.
This was our first real machine, Gordon said proudly.
Wait a minute, Stern said. Does this thing work?
Yes, of course.
Does it work now?
It hasn't been used for some time, Gordon said, but I imagine it does. Why?
So if I wanted to go back and help them, Stern said, then I could. In this machine. Is that right?
Yes, Gordon said, nodding slowly. You could go back in this machine, but...
Look, I think they're in trouble back there, or worse.
Probably. Yes.
And you're telling me we have a machine that works, Stern said. Right now.
Gordon sighed.
I'm afraid it's a little more complicated than that, David.
29 hours, 10 minutes, 0 seconds. Kate fell in slow motion as the plaster gave way, and as she descended, her fingers closed on the ragged plaster edge, and with the practice of many years, she gripped it, and it held. She hung by one hand, looking down as the plaster dropped another 50 feet to the floor of the chapel, where it shattered in a cloud of dust. She didn't see what had happened to the soldiers. She raised her other hand, grabbing the plaster. This edge would break away any minute, she knew. The whole ceiling was crumbling. Structurally, the greatest strength would occur near the reinforced line of the groin, where the arches met in a line of solid stone, or the side wall of the chapel, which was also stone. She decided to try and get to the side wall. The plaster broke away in her right hand. She dangled from her left. She crossed one hand over the other, reaching as far as she could manage, trying again to spread the weight of her body. The plaster in her left hand broke free, another big chunk falling to the floor. Again she swung in the air and found another handhold. She was now only 3 feet from the side wall, and the plaster was noticeably thicker as it swelled to meet the wall. The edge she was holding felt more stable. She heard soldiers below shouting and running into the chapel. It would not be long before they were shooting arrows at her. She tried to swing her left leg up. The more she could distribute her weight, the better she would be. She got the leg up. The plaster held. Twisting her torso, she pulled her body up onto the plaster shelf, then brought her second leg up. The first of the arrows whistled past her. Others thunked against the plaster, raising little white puffs. She was lying flat on top of the roof. But she could not stay here. She rolled away from the edge toward the groin line. As she did, more plaster broke away and fell again. The soldiers stopped shouting. Maybe the plaster hit one of them, she thought. But no. She heard them running hastily out of the church. She heard men outside shouting and horses whinnying. What was going on? Inside the tower room, Chris heard the scrape of the key in the lock. Then the soldiers outside paused and shouted through the door, calling to the guard inside the room. Meanwhile, Merrick was searching like a madman. He was on his knees, looking under the bed. "Got it!" he cried. He scrambled to his feet, holding a broadsword and a long dagger. He tossed the dagger to Chris. Outside, the soldiers were again shouting to the guard inside. Merrick moved toward the door and gestured for Chris to step to the other side. Chris pressed back flat against the wall by the door. He heard the voices of the men outside, many voices. His heart began to pound. He had been shocked by the way Merrick killed the guard. "They're coming to kill you." He heard the words repeated over and over in his head with a sense of unreality. It didn't seem possible that armed men were coming to kill him. In the comfort of the library, he had read accounts of past violent acts, murder, and slaughter. He had read descriptions of streets slippery with blood, soldiers soaked in red from head to foot, women and children eviscerated despite their piteous pleas. But somehow, Chris had always assumed these stories were exaggerated, overstated. Within the university, it was the fashion to interpret documents ironically, to talk about the naivete of narrative, the context of text, the privileging of power. Such theoretical posturing turned history into a clever intellectual game. Chris was good at the game, but playing it, he had somehow lost track of a more straightforward reality. That the old texts recounted horrific stories and violent episodes that were all too often true. He had lost track of the fact that he was reading history. Until now, when it was forcibly brought to his attention. The key turned in the lock. On the other side of the door, Merrick's face was fixed in a snarl, his lips drawn back, showing teeth clenched. He was like an animal, Chris thought. Merrick's body was taut as he gripped his sword, ready to swing, ready to kill. The door pushed open, momentarily blocking Chris's view, but he saw Merrick swing high, and he heard a scream and a huge gush of blood splashed onto the floor,
and a body soon fell after. The door banged against his body, stopping its full swing and pinning Chris behind it. On the other side, a man slammed against it, then gasped as a sword splintered wood. Chris tried to get out from behind the door, but another body fell, blocking his way. He stepped over the body, and the door thunked flat against the wall as Merrick swung at another attacker, and a third soldier staggered away with the impact and fell to the floor at Chris's feet. The soldier's torso was drenched in blood. Blood gurgled out of his chest like a flowing spring. Chris bent down to take the sword still in the man's hand. As he pulled at the sword, the man gripped it tightly, grimacing at Chris. Abruptly, the soldier weakened and released the sword, so that Chris staggered back against the wall. The man continued to stare at him from the floor, his face contorted in a grimace of fury, and then it froze. "Jesus," he thought. "He's dead." Suddenly, to his right, another soldier stepped into the room, his back to Chris as he fought Merrick. Their swords clanged. They fought fiercely. But the man had not noticed Chris, and Chris raised his sword, which felt very heavy and unwieldy. He wondered if he could swing it, if he could actually kill the man whose back was turned to him. He lifted the sword, cocked his arm as if he were batting, and prepared to swing. When Merrick cut the man's arm off at the shoulder, the dismembered arm shot across the floor and thumped to rest against the wall beneath the window. The man looked astonished for the instant before Merrick cut his head off in a single swing, and the head tumbled through the air, banged against the door next to Chris, and fell onto his toes, facing downward. Hastily, he jerked his feet away. The head rolled so the face was turned upward, and Chris saw the eyes blink and the mouth move, as if forming words. He backed away. Chris looked away to the torso on the floor, still pumping blood from the stump of the neck. The blood flowed freely over the stone floor. Gallons of blood, it seemed like. He looked at Merrick, now sitting on the bed, gasping for breath, his face and doublet splattered with blood. Merrick looked up at him.
"You all right?" he said.
Chris couldn't answer. He couldn't say anything at all. And then the bell in the village church began to ring. Through the window, Chris saw flames licking up from two farmhouses at the far edge of the town, near the circling town wall. Men were running in the streets toward it.
"There's a fire," Chris said.
"I doubt it," Merrick said, still sitting by the bed.
"No, there is," Chris said. "Look."
In the town, horsemen were galloping through the streets. They were dressed as merchants or traders, but they rode like fighters.
"This is a typical diversion," Merrick said. "To start an attack."
"An attack?"
"The archpriest is attacking Castelgar."
"So soon?"
"This is just an advance party. Perhaps 100 soldiers or so. They'll try to create confusion, disruption. The main body is probably still on the other side of the river, but the attack has begun."
Apparently others thought so too. In the courtyard below, courtiers were streaming out of the great hall and hurrying toward the drawbridge. Leaving the castle, the party abruptly ended. A company of armored knights galloped out, scattering the courtiers, thundered across the drawbridge, and raced down through the streets of the town. Kate stuck her head in the door, panting.
"Guys, let's go. We have to find the professor before it's too late."
28 hours, 57 minutes, 32 seconds. There was pandemonium in the great hall. The musicians fled. The guests rushed out the doors. Dogs barked and plates of food clattered on the floor. Knights were running to join the battle, shouting orders to their squires. From the high table, Lord Oliver came quickly down, grabbed the professor by the arm, and said to Sir Guy,
"We go to La Roque, see to the Lady Claire, and bring the assistance."
Robert de Care burst breathlessly into the room.
"My lord, the assistants are dead, killed while trying to escape."
"Escape? They tried to escape? Even if that risked their master's life?"
"Come with me, Magister," Lord Oliver said darkly.
Oliver led him to a side door that opened directly to the courtyard. Kate scrambled down the circular staircase with Merrick and Chris close behind. At the second floor, they had to slow for a group descending ahead of them. Around the curve, Kate glimpsed ladies in waiting and the red robes of an elderly, shuffling man. Behind her, Chris yelled, "What's the problem?" And Kate held up a warning hand. It was another minute before they burst through into the courtyard. It was a chaotic scene. Knights on horseback whipped the throng of panicked revelers to force them aside. She heard the cries of the crowd, the whinny of horses, the shouts of soldiers on the battlements above. "This way," Kate said, and she led Merrick and Chris forward, staying close to the castle wall, going around the chapel, then laterally into the outer courtyard, which they could see was equally crowded. They saw Oliver on horseback, the professor at his side, and a company of armored knights. Oliver shouted something and moved all forward toward the drawbridge. Kate left Merrick and Chris to chase them alone, and she just managed to catch sight of them at the end of the drawbridge. Oliver turned to the left, riding away from the town. Guards opened a door in the east wall, and he and his company rode through into the afternoon sunlight. The door was shut hastily behind them. Merrick caught up with her. "Where?" he said. She pointed to the gate. 30 knights guarded it. More stood on the wall above. "We'll never get out that way," he said. Just behind them, a cluster of soldiers threw off brown tunics, revealing green and black surcoats. They began fighting their way into the castle. The drawbridge chains began to clank. "Come on." They ran down the drawbridge, hearing the wood creak, feeling it begin to rise under their feet. The drawbridge was 3 feet in the air when they reached the far end and jumped, landing on the ground of the open field. "Now what?" Chris said, picking himself up. He still carried his bloody sword in his hand. "This way," Merrick said, and he ran straight into the center of the town. They headed toward the church, then away from the narrow main street, where intense fighting had already begun. Oliver's soldiers in maroon and gray, and Arnaud's in green and black. Merrick led them to the left, through the market, now deserted, the wares packed up and the merchants gone. They had to step quickly aside as a company of Arnaud's knights on horseback galloped past, heading toward the castle. One of them swung at Merrick with his broadsword and shouted something as he passed. Merrick watched them go, then went on. Chris was looking for signs of murdered women and eviscerated babies, and he did not know whether to be disappointed or relieved that he saw none. In fact, he saw no women or children at all. "They've all run away or gone into hiding," Merrick said. "There's been a war for a long time here. People know what to do." "Which way?" Kate said. She was in the front. "Left, toward the main gate." They turned left, going down a narrower street, and suddenly heard a shout behind them. They looked back to see running soldiers coming toward them. Chris couldn't tell if the soldiers were chasing them or just running, but there was no point in waiting to find out. Merrick broke into a run. They all ran now. And after a while, Chris glanced back to see the soldiers were falling behind, and he felt a moment of odd pride. They were putting distance between them. But Merrick was taking no chances. Abruptly, he turned down into a side street which had a strong and unpleasant odor. The shops here were all closed up, but narrow alleyways ran between each. Merrick ran down one, which brought them to a fenced courtyard behind the shop. Within the courtyard stood huge wooden vats and wooden racks beneath the shed. Here the stench was almost overpowering, a mixture of rotting flesh and feces. It was a tannery. "Quickly," Merrick said, as they climbed over the fence, crouched down behind the reeking vats.
"Oof," Kate said, holding her nose. "What is that smell?"
"They soak the skins in chicken shit," Chris whispered. "The nitrogen in the feces softens the leather."
"Great," she said. "Dog shit, too."
"Great."
Chris looked back and saw more vats and hides hanging on the racks. Here and there, stinking piles of cheesy yellow material lay heaped on the ground, fat scraped from the inside of the skins. Kate said, "My eyes burn." Chris pointed to the white crust on the vats around them. These were lime vats, a harsh alkali solution that removed all the hair and remaining flesh after the skins were scraped. And it was the lime fumes that burned their eyes. Then his attention was drawn to the alleyway, where he heard running feet and the clatter of armor. Through the fence he saw Robert de Care with 7 soldiers. The soldiers were looking in every direction as they ran, searching for them. Why? Chris wondered, peering around the vat. Why were they still being pursued? What was so important about them that Decare would ignore an enemy attack and try instead to kill them? Apparently, the searchers liked the smell in the alley no better than Chris did, because soon Decare barked an order, and they all ran back up the alley toward the street.
What was that all about?
Chris whispered finally. Merrick just shook his head. And then they heard men shouting, and again they heard the soldiers running back down the street. Chris frowned. How could they have overheard? He looked at Merrick, who seemed troubled too. From outside the courtyard, they heard Decare shout, "Ici! Ici!" Probably Decare had left a man behind. That must be it, Chris thought, because he hadn't whispered loudly enough to be heard. Merrick started forward, then hesitated. Already Decare and his men were climbing over the fence, 8 men all together. They could not fight them all.
Andre, Chris said, pointing to the vat. It's lie.
Merrick grinned. Then let's do it, he said, and he leaned against the vat. They all put their shoulders against the wood and, with effort, managed to push the vat over. Frothing alkali solution sloshed onto the ground and flowed toward the soldiers. The odor was acrid. The soldiers instantly recognized what it was. Any contact with that liquid would burn flesh, and they scrambled back up the fence, getting their feet off the ground. The fence posts began to sizzle and hiss when the lie touched them. The fence wobbled with the weight of all the men. They shouted and scrambled back into the alley. Now, Merrick said. He led them deeper into the tanning yard, up over a shed, and then out into another alley. It was now late afternoon, and the light was fading rapidly. Ahead they saw the burning farmhouses, which cast hard, flickering shadows on the ground. Earlier there had been attempts to put out the fires, but they were now abandoned. The thatch burned freely, crackling as burning strands rose into the air. They were following a narrow path that ran among pigsties. The pigs snorted and squealed, distressed by the fires that burned nearby. Merrick skirted the fires, heading toward the south gate, where they had first come in. But even from a distance, they could see that the gate was the scene of heavy fighting. The entrance was nearly blocked by the bodies of dead horses. Arno's soldiers had to scramble over the corpses to reach the defenders inside, who fought bitterly with axes and swords. Merrick turned away, doubling back through the farm area. Where are we going? Chris said. Not sure, Merrick said. He was looking up at the curtain wall around the town. Soldiers ran along it, heading toward the south gate to join in the fight. I want to get up on that wall.
Up on the wall?
There. He pointed to a narrow, dark opening in the wall, with steps going up. They emerged on top of the town wall. From their high vantage point, they could see that more of the town was being engulfed in flames. Fires were closer to the shops. Soon all Castelgar would be burning. Merrick looked over the wall at the fields beyond. The ground was 20 feet below. There were some bushes about 5 feet high, which looked soft enough to break their impact, but it was getting hard to see.
Stay loose, he said. Keep your body relaxed.
Loose? Chris said.
But already Kate had swung her body over and was hanging from the wall. She released her grip and fell the rest of the way, landing on her feet like a cat. She looked up at them and beckoned.
It's pretty far down, Chris said. I don't want to break a leg.
From the right they heard shouts. 3 soldiers ran along the wall, their swords raised.
Then don't, Merrick said, and jumped.
Chris jumped after him in the twilight, landing on the ground, grunting and rolling. He got slowly to his feet. Nothing broken. He was feeling relieved and rather pleased with himself when the first of the arrows whined past his ear and thunked into the ground between his feet. Soldiers were shooting at them from the wall above. Merrick grabbed his arm and ran to dense undergrowth 10 yards away. They dropped down and waited. Almost immediately, more arrows whistled overhead, but this time they came from outside the castle walls. In the growing darkness, Chris could barely make out soldiers in green and black surcoats on the hill below.
Those are Arno's men, Chris said. Why are they shooting at us?
Merrick didn't answer. He was crawling away, his belly flat to the ground. Kate crawled after him. An arrow hissed past Chris, so close the shaft tore his doublet at the shoulder, and he felt a brief streak of pain. He threw himself flat on the ground and followed them. 28 hours,
12 minutes, 39 seconds. There's good news and bad news, Diane Kramer said, walking into Doniger's office just before 9 in the morning. Doniger was at his computer, pecking at the keyboard with one hand while he held a can of Coke in the other. Give me the bad news, Doniger said. Our injured people were taken to University Hospital. When they got there last night, guess who was on duty? The same doctor who treated Traub and Gallup. A woman named Tsotsi.
The same doctor works both hospitals?
Yes. She's mostly at UH, but she does 2 days a week at Gallup.
Shit, Doniger said. Is that legal?
Sure. Anyway, Dr. Tsotsi went over our techs with a fine-tooth comb. She even put 3 of them through an MRI. She reserved the scan especially as soon as she heard it was an accident involving ITC.
An MRI? Doniger frowned. That means she must have known that Traub was split.
Yes, Kramer said, because apparently they put Traub through an MRI. So she was definitely looking for something, physical defects, body misalignments.
Shit,
Doniger said. She also made a big deal about her quest, getting everybody at the hospital huffy and paranoid, and she called that cop Waneka in Gallup. It seems they're friends. Doniger groaned. I need this, he said, like I need another asshole. Now you want the good news?
I'm ready.
Waneka calls the Albuquerque police. The chief goes down to the hospital himself, a couple of reporters. Everybody's sitting around waiting for the big news. They're expecting radioactive. They're expecting glow in the dark. Instead, big embarrassment. All the injuries are pretty minor. Mostly, it's flying glass. Even the shrapnel wounds are superficial. The metal's just embedded in the skin layer.
Water shields must have slowed the fragments down, Doniger said.
I think so, yes. But people are pretty disappointed. And then the final event, the MRI, the coup de grace, is a bust 3 times running. None of our people has any transcription errors, because, of course, they're just techs. Albuquerque chief is pissed. Hospital administrator is pissed. Reporters leave to cover a burning apartment building. Meanwhile, some guy with kidney stones almost dies because they can't do an MRI because Dr. Tsotsi's tied up the machine. Suddenly, she's worried about her job. Waneka's disgraced. They both run for cover.
Perfect, Doniger said, pounding the table. He grinned. Those dipshits deserve it.
And to top it all off, Kramer said triumphantly, the French reporter, Louise Delvert, has agreed to come tour our facility.
Finally! When?
Next week. We'll give her the usual bullshit tour. This is starting to be an ultra-good day, Doniger said. You know, we might actually get this thing back in the bottle. Is that it? The media people are coming at noon. That belongs under bad news, Doniger said. And Stern has found the old prototype machine. He wants to go back. Gordon said absolutely not, but Stern wants you to confirm that he can't go. Doniger paused.
I say let him go.
Bob?
Why shouldn't he go?
Doniger said. Because it's unsafe as hell. That machine has minimal shielding. It hasn't been used in years, and it's got a history of causing big transcription errors on the people who did use it. He might not even come back at all.
I know that. Doniger waved his hand. None of that's core.
What's core? She said, confused.
Barreto.
Barreto?
Do I hear an echo? Diane, think, for Christ's sake.
Kramer frowned, shook her head.
Put it together. Barreto died in the first minute or two of the trip back. Isn't that right? Someone shot him full of arrows right in the beginning of the trip.
Yes.
The first few minutes, Doniger said, is the time when everybody is still standing around the machines together as a group, right? So what reason do we have to think that Barreto got killed but nobody else?
Kramer said nothing.
What's reasonable is that whoever killed Barreto probably killed them all, killed the whole bunch.
Okay.
That means they probably aren't coming back. The professor isn't coming back. The whole group is gone. Now, it's unfortunate, but we can handle a group of missing people. A tragic lab accident where all the bodies were incinerated, or a plane crash, nobody would really be the wiser.
There was a pause. Except there's Stern, Kramer said. He'd know the whole story.
That's right.
So you want to send him back, too? Get rid of him as well? Clean sweep?
Not at all,
Doniger said promptly. Hey, I'm opposed to it. But the guy's volunteering. He wants to help his friends. It'd be wrong for me to stand in the way.
Bob, she said, there are times when you are a real asshole.
Doniger suddenly started to laugh. He had a high-pitched, whooping, hysterical laugh, like a little kid. It was the way a lot of the scientists laughed, but it always reminded Kramer of a hyena.
If you allow Stern to go back, I quit.
This made Doniger laugh even harder. Sitting in his chair, he threw back his head. It made her angry.
I mean it, Bob.
He finally stopped giggling, wiped the tears from his eyes. Diane, come on, he said. I'm kidding. Of course Stern can't go back. Where's your sense of humor?
Kramer turned to go. I'll tell Stern that he can't go back, she said. But you weren't kidding.
Doniger started laughing all over again. Hyena giggles filled the room. Kramer slammed the door angrily as she left.
27 hours, 27 minutes, 22 seconds. For the last 40 minutes, they had been scrambling up through the forest northeast of Castelgar. At last, they came to the top of the hill, the highest point in the area, and they could pause to catch their breath and look down.
Oh, my God,
Kate said, staring. They looked down on the river and the monastery on the opposite side, but their attention was drawn to the forbidding castle high above the monastery, the fortress of Laroque. It was enormous. In the deepening blue of evening, the castle glowed with light from 100 windows and from torches along the battlements. But despite the glowing lights, the fortress was ominous. The outer walls were black above the still waters of the moat. Inside was another complete set of walls with many round towers, and at the center of the complex, the actual castle with its own great hall and a dark rectangular tower rising more than 100 feet into the air.
Merrick said to Kate, "Does it look like modern Laroque?"
"Not at all," she said, shaking her head. "This thing is gigantic. The modern castle has only one outer wall. This one has two, an additional ring wall that is no longer there."
"So far as I know," Merrick said, "nobody ever captured it by force."
"You can see why," Chris said. "Look how it's sited."
On the east and south side, the fortress was built atop a limestone cliff, a sheer drop of 500 feet to the Dordogne below. On the west, where the cliff was less vertical, the stone houses of the town climbed up toward the castle, but anyone following the road through the town would end up facing a broad moat and several drawbridges. On the north, the land sloped more gently away, but all the trees on the north had been cut down, leaving an exposed plain without cover, a suicidal approach for any army.
Merrick pointed. "Look there," he said.
In the twilight, a party of soldiers approached the castle on a dirt road from the west. Two knights in the lead held torches, and by that light they could just barely discern Sir Oliver, Sir Guy, the professor, and the rest of Oliver's knights bringing up the rear in two columns. The figures were so far away that they really recognized them by body shape and posture. But Chris, at least, had no doubt what he was seeing. He sighed as he watched the riders cross a drawbridge over a moat, pass through a large gatehouse with half-round twin towers, a so-called double D gate, because the towers looked like twin Ds when seen from above. Soldiers atop the towers watched the riders as they passed through. Beyond the gatehouse, the riders entered another enclosed courtyard. Here, many long wooden buildings had been erected.
"That's where the troops are garrisoned," Kate said.
The party rode across this inner courtyard, crossed a second moat over a second drawbridge, passing through a second gatehouse with even larger twin towers, 30 feet high and glowing with light from dozens of arrow slits. Only then did they dismount in the innermost court of the castle. The professor was led by Oliver toward the great hall. They disappeared inside. Kate said, "The professor said that if we were separated, we should go to the monastery and find Brother Marcel, who has the key. I assume he meant the key to the secret passage."
Merrick nodded. "And that's what we're going to do. It'll be dark soon. Then we can go."
Chris looked down the hill. In the gloom, he could see small bands of soldiers in the fields, all the way down to the river's edge. They would have to make their way past all those soldiers.
You want to go to the monastery tonight?
Merrick nodded.
However dangerous it looks now, he said, tomorrow morning it will be worse.
26 hours, 12 minutes, 1 second. There was no moon. The sky was black and filled with stars, with the occasional drifting cloud. Merrick led them down the hill and past the burning town of Kestelgar, into a dark landscape. Chris was surprised to find that once his eyes adjusted, he could actually see quite well by starlight. Probably because there was no air pollution, he thought. He remembered reading that in earlier centuries, people could see the planet Venus during the day as we can now see the moon. Of course, that had been impossible for hundreds of years. He was also surprised by the utter silence of the night. The loudest sound they heard was their feet moving through the grass and past the scrubby bushes.
"We'll go to the path," Merrick whispered, "then down to the river."
Their progress was slow. Frequently Merrick paused, crouching down to listen for 2 or 3 minutes before moving on. Almost an hour passed before they came within sight of the dirt path that ran from the town to the river. It was a pale streak against the darker grass and foliage that surrounded it. Here Merrick paused. The silence around them was complete. He heard only the faint sound of the wind. Chris felt impatient to get started. After a full minute of waiting, he started to get up. Merrick pushed him down. He held his finger to his lips. Chris listened. It was more than wind, he realized. There was also the sound of men whispering. He strained to hear. There was a quiet cough somewhere ahead, then another cough, closer, on their side of the road. Merrick pointed left and right. Chris saw a faint silver glint, armor, in starlight, among the bushes opposite the path, and he heard rustling closer by. It was an ambush, soldiers waiting on both sides of the path. Merrick pointed back the way they had come. Quietly, they moved away from the path.
"Where now?" Chris whispered.
"We'll stay away from the path. Go east to the river, that way."
Merrick pointed, and they set out. Chris felt on edge now, straining to hear the slightest sound. Their own footsteps were so loud, they masked any other sound. He understood now why Merrick had stopped so often. It was the only way to be sure. They went back 200 yards from the path, then headed down to the river, moving between the fields of cleared land. Even though it was nearly black, Chris felt exposed. The fields were walled in low stone, so they had a slight cover from that. But he was still uneasy, and he gave a sigh of relief when they moved back into uncleared shrub land, darker in the night. This silent black world was entirely alien to him, yet he quickly adjusted to it. Danger lay in the tiniest movements, in sounds that were almost inaudible. Chris moved in a crouch, tense, testing each footstep before applying full weight, his head constantly turning left and right, left and right. He felt like an animal, and he thought of the way Merrick had bared his teeth before the attack in the room, like some kind of ape. He looked over at Kate and saw that she, too, was crouched and tense as she moved forward. For some reason, he found himself thinking of the seminar room on the second floor of the Peabody, back at Yale, with the cream-colored walls and the polished dark wood trim, and of the arguments among the graduate students sitting around the long table. Whether processual archaeology was primarily historical or primarily archaeological. Whether formalist criteria outweighed objectivist criteria. Whether derivationist doctrine concealed normative commitment. It was no wonder, they argued. The issues were pure abstractions, consisting of nothing but thin air and hot air. Their empty debates could never be resolved. The questions could never be answered. Yet there had been so much intensity, so much passion in those debates. Where had it come from? Who cared? He couldn't quite remember now why it had been so important. The academic world seemed to be receding into the distance, vague and gray in memory, as he made his way down the dark hillside toward the river. Yet however frightened he was on this night, however tense and at risk of his life, it was entirely real in some way that was reassuring.
even exhilarating, and... He heard a twig snap, and he froze. Merrick and Kate froze, too. They heard soft rustling in the brush to the left and a low snort. They stayed motionless. Merrick gripped his sword. And the small, dark shape of a wild pig snuffled past them.
Should have killed it, Merrick whispered. I'm hungry.
They started to continue forward, but then Chris realized that they were not the ones who had frightened the pig, because now they heard, unmistakably, the sound of many running feet, rustling, crashing in the underbrush, coming toward them. Merrick frowned. He could see enough in the darkness to catch glimpses of metal armor now and again. There must be 7 or 8 soldiers moving hastily east, then dropping down, hiding in the brush again, becoming silent. What the hell was going on? These soldiers had been back at the dirt path, waiting for them. Now the soldiers had moved east and were waiting for them again. How? He looked at Kate, crouched beside him, but she just looked frightened. Chris, also crouching, tapped Merrick on the shoulder. Chris shook his head, then pointed deliberately to his own ear. Merrick nodded, listened. At first he heard nothing but the wind. Puzzled, he looked back at Chris, who made a distinct tapping motion against the side of his head by his ear. He was saying, "Turn on your earpiece." Merrick tapped his ear. After a brief cackle as the sound came on, he heard nothing. He shrugged at Chris, who held up his flat palms. "Wait." Merrick waited. Only after a few moments of quiet listening did he become aware of the soft, regular sound of a person breathing. He looked at Kate and held his finger to his lips. She nodded. He looked at Chris. He nodded too. They both understood. Make no noise at all. Again, Merrick listened intently. He still heard the sound of quiet breathing in his earpiece, but it wasn't coming from any of them. Someone else. Chris whispered, "Andre, this is too dangerous. Let's not cross the river tonight."
"Right," Merrick whispered. "We'll go back to Kestelgar and hide out for the night against the walls."
"Okay, good. Let's go." In the darkness, they nodded to each other. Then they deliberately tapped their ears, turning their earpieces off. And they crouched down to wait. In a few moments, they heard the soldiers start to move, once again running through the underbrush. This time they were going up the hill, back toward Kestelgar. They waited another 5 or 6 minutes, and then they headed down the hill, away from Kestelgar. It was Chris who had put it all together. Climbing down the hillside in the night, he had brushed a mosquito away from his ear, and the movement had inadvertently turned his earpiece on. Not long afterward, he had heard someone sneeze, and none of them had sneezed. A few moments later, they had come upon the pig, and by then he was hearing someone panting with exertion, while Kate and Merrick, in the darkness beside him, were not moving at all. That was when he realized for certain that someone else had an earpiece, and thinking it over now, he had a pretty good idea where it had come from. Gomez. Somebody must have taken it from Gomez's severed head. The only problem with that idea was... Merrick nudged him, pointed ahead. Kate gave the thumbs-up sign and grinned. Broad and flat, the river rippled and gurgled in the night. The Dordogne was wide at this point. They could barely see the far shore, a line of dark trees and dense undergrowth. They saw no sign of movement. Looking upstream, Chris could just make out the dark outline of the mill bridge. He knew the mill would be closed up at night. Millers could only work during the daylight hours, because even a candle risked causing an explosion in the dusty air. Merrick touched Chris on the arm, then pointed toward the opposite bank. Chris shrugged. He saw nothing. Merrick pointed again. Squinting, Chris could barely discern 3 wisps of pale smoke rising into the sky. But if they came from fires, why was there no light? Following the riverbank, they moved upstream and eventually came upon a boat tied to the shore. It thunked against rocks in the current. Merrick looked toward the opposite shore. They were now some distance from the fires. He pointed to the boat. Did they want to risk it? The alternative, Chris knew, was to swim the river. The night was chilly. He didn't want to get wet. He pointed to the boat and nodded. Kate nodded. They climbed aboard, and Merrick rowed them quietly across the Dordogne.
Sitting next to Chris, Kate found herself thinking of their conversation while crossing the river a few days earlier. How many days had it been? It must be only 2 days ago, she realized, but it seemed like weeks to her. She squinted at the far shore, looking for any movement. Their boat would be a dark shape on dark water against a dark hill, but they would still be visible if anyone was looking. But apparently no one was. The shore was closer now, and then with a hiss the boat moved into the grass along the banks and crunched to a soft stop. They climbed out. They saw a narrow dirt path that followed the edge of the river. Merrick held his fingers to his lips and started down the path. He was going toward the fires. They followed cautiously. A few minutes later, they had their answer. There were 4 fires, placed at intervals along the riverbank. The flames were surrounded by pieces of broken armor atop mounds of earth, so that only the smoke was visible. But there were no soldiers. Merrick whispered, "Old trick. Fires give false position." Kate wasn't quite sure what the old trick was meant to accomplish. Perhaps to indicate greater strength, greater numbers than you really had. Merrick led them past the row of untended fires toward several other ranged farther along the riverbank. They were close to the water, hearing the gurgling of the river. As they came to the last fire, Merrick abruptly spun on his heel and dropped to the ground. Kate and Chris dropped too, and then they heard voices singing a repetitive drinking song. The lyrics were something about ale makes a man slumber by fire, ale makes a man wallow in mire. It went on interminably. Listening to the lyrics, she thought, this is 99 bottles of beer on the wall. And soon enough, as she raised her head to look, she saw 6 soldiers in green and black, sitting around a fire, drinking and singing loudly. Perhaps they had been ordered to make enough noise to justify all the fires. Merrick pointed for them to go back, and when they had moved a distance away, he led them off to the left, away from the river. They left behind the cover of trees that lined the river, then were again slipping through open, cleared fields. She realized that these were the same fields where she had been that morning, and sure enough, now she could see on the left faint yellow lights in the upper windows of the monastery as some of the monks worked late, and the dark outlines of thatched farm huts directly ahead. Chris pointed toward the monastery. Why weren't they going there? Merrick made a pillow with his hands. Everybody's sleeping. Chris shrugged. So? Merrick pantomimed waking up, startled, alarmed. He seemed to mean that they would cause a commotion if they went in the middle of the night. Chris shrugged. So? Merrick wagged a finger. Not a good idea. He mouthed, "In the morning." Chris sighed. Merrick went past the farm huts until he came to a burned-down farmhouse, 4 walls, and the black remains of timbers that had supported a thatched roof. He led them inside through an open door that had a red streak across it. Kate could barely see it in the darkness. Inside the hut was tall grass and some pieces of broken crockery. Merrick began rummaging through the grass until he came up with 2 clay pots with cracked rims. They looked like chamber pots to Kate. Merrick set them out carefully on 1 burned windowsill. She whispered, "Where do we sleep?" Merrick pointed to the ground. "Why can't we go into the monastery?" she whispered, gesturing to the open sky above them. The night was cold. She was hungry. She wanted the comfort of an enclosed space. "Not safe," Merrick whispered. "We sleep here." He lay on the ground and closed his eyes. "Why isn't it safe?" she said. "Because somebody has an earpiece, and they know where we're going." Chris said, "I wanted to talk to you about..." "Not now," Merrick said without opening his eyes. "Go to sleep." She lay down, and Chris lay beside her. She pushed her back against his. It was just for warmth. It was so damn cold. In the distance, she heard the rumble of thunder. Sometime after midnight, it began to rain. She felt the heavy drops on her cheeks, and she got to her feet just as the downpour started. She looked around and saw a small wooden shed, partially burned, but still standing. She crawled under it, sitting upright, again huddling together with Chris, who had joined her. Merrick came over, lay down nearby, and immediately went back to sleep.
She saw raindrops spatter his cheeks, but he was snoring.
26 hours, 12 minutes, 1 second. Half a dozen hot air balloons were rising above the mesas in the morning sun. It was now almost 10 o'clock. One of the balloons had a zigzag pattern which reminded Stern of a Navajo sand painting.
"I'm sorry," Gordon was saying, "but the answer is no. You can't go back in the prototype, David. It's just too dangerous."
"Why? I thought this was all so safe. Safer than a car. What's dangerous?"
"I told you we don't have transcription errors. The errors that occurred during rebuilding," Gordon said. "But that's not precisely accurate."
"Ah."
"Ordinarily, it's true that we can't find any evidence of errors. But they probably occur during every trip. They're just too minor to detect. But like radiation exposure, transcription errors are cumulative. You can't see them after one trip, but after 10 or 20 trips, the signs start to be visible. Maybe you have a small seam like a scar in your skin, a small streak in your cornea. Or maybe you begin to have noticeable symptoms like diabetes or circulatory problems. Once that happens, you can't go anymore, because you can't afford to have the problems get worse. That means you've reached your trip limit."
"And that's happened?"
"Yes, to some lab animals, and to several people. The pioneers, the ones who used this prototype machine."
Stern hesitated. "Where are those people now?"
"Most of them are still here, still working for us. But they don't travel anymore. They can't."
"Okay," Stern said, "but I'm only talking about one trip."
"And we haven't used or calibrated this machine for a long time," Gordon said. "It may be okay, and it may not be. Look, suppose I let you go back, and after you arrive in 1357, you discover you have errors so serious you don't dare return, because you couldn't risk more accumulation."
"You're saying I'd have to stay back there?"
"Yes."
Stern said, "Has that ever happened to anybody?"
Gordon paused. "Possibly."
"You mean there's somebody back there now?"
"Possibly," Gordon said. "We're not sure."
"But this is very important to know," Stern said, suddenly excited. "You're telling me there might be somebody already back there who could help them?"
"I don't know," Gordon said, "if this particular person would help."
"But shouldn't we tell them? Advise them?"
"There's no way to make contact with them."
"Actually," Stern said, "I think there is." 16 hours, 12 minutes, 23 seconds. Shivering and cold, Chris awoke before dawn. The sky was pale gray, the ground covered by a thin mist. He was sitting under the shed, his knees pulled up to his chin, his back against the wall. Kate sat beside him, still asleep. He shifted his body to look out and winced with sudden pain. All his muscles were cramped and sore. His arms, his legs, his chest, everywhere. His neck hurt when he turned his head. He was surprised to find the shoulder of his tunic was stiff with dried blood. Apparently the arrow the night before had cut him enough to cause bleeding. Chris moved his arm experimentally, sucking in his breath with pain, but he decided that he was all right. He shivered in the morning damp. What he wanted now was a warm fire and something to eat. His stomach was growling. He hadn't eaten for more than 24 hours, and he was thirsty. Where were they going to find water? Could you drink water from the Dordogne? Or did they need to find a spring? And where were they going to find food? He turned to ask Merrick, but Merrick wasn't there. He twisted to look around the farmhouse. Sharp pain, lots of pain. But Merrick was gone. He had just begun to get his feet when he heard the sound of approaching footsteps. Merrick? No, he decided. He was hearing the footsteps of more than one person. And he heard the soft clink of chainmail. The footsteps came close, then stopped. He held his breath. To the right, barely 3 feet from his head, a chainmail gauntlet appeared through the open window and rested on the windowsill. The sleeve above the gauntlet was green, trimmed in black. "Arnaud's men." "Hic nemo habitavit nuper," a male voice said. A reply came from the doorway.
et intelligo quare, specta porta habet signum rubrum, est ne pestilentiae?
Pestilentia? Certo cisne?